Welcome to the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project, which is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Idaho, and Washington State University. Part of the project's mission is to collect, preserve, and make public oral histories documenting the history and people of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. For more information, please visit our website at sbw.lib.uidaho.edu.
And then I think people get so much out of being in a wilderness setting. Once you take away cars and money and telephones, people are different, and they are different to each other, I think. And then they draw on things in themselves that maybe are a little rusty from our crazy life out here now. I think the ways that people get along when they're isolated in a place like that, place that they want to be, are really, it's a wonderful thing.
Thank you for joining us for the 40th episode of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project. In this episode, titled Rewilding, Jane Holman describes some of the practical aspects of returning settled sections of the Selway Bitterroot Country to wilderness. Jane graduated from the University of Montana after growing up in Dixie, Idaho. She spent the years of 1968 to 1972 at Moose Creek Ranger Station with her husband, Bill Holman, who was the wilderness ranger there. From there, she moved to Washington, D.C., and spent 29 years working for the U.S. Department of Education, although she always revisited her Idaho roots. After retirement in 2004, she returned to Moscow, Idaho. Among other pursuits, she serves as a secretary for the Selway Bitterroot Foundation and remains active in stewarding the wilderness, both politically and on the ground.
So do you remember any points where you were, where there was like a conflict or some decision that had to be made that was different now that the Wilderness Act was being implemented, like for chainsaws or roads or vehicles back there, or I mean, just some points where a decision was made after the Wilderness Act that would have been a different decision before it? Were you there for any of those?
Oh, sure. I think the first fall, probably in 68, there was, hunting season was about to start. It was in mid-September, I think. And I think it was the Three Links Crossing Trail from Big Fog hadn't been cut out. And, of course, the outfitters used that trail and all that, so we knew that that had to be cut out. So Bill and I and Emil and Penny and a couple of head of stock, I think, we had pack stock, we weren't riding, headed up there to cut out the trail. And, of course, Emil had a chainsaw, and he was, you know, chaining away because we had to get it done because hunting season started, you know, like the next day or whatever. And anyhow, so those were kind of interesting things that... Bill went along with, I think, at that point, in order to have the trail open. I think we didn't do that anymore, or I don't think Bill did it anymore after that I recall, anyway. Emil may well have, because he was off by himself a lot.
I see, but you were aware at that.
Oh yeah,
at that point where maybe 5 years before you wouldn't.
Oh, I would never have thought a thing about it. A silly little thing. I remember from being on the Salmon River that when you would hike down a trail and you'd cross a creek, there was always an old tin can on a bush someplace because you could use it to drink. And that was just what people did for each other because that was how you managed in the backwoods. And I remember remarking on that, and of course it was very anti-wilderness that you would leave any old tin cans along the creek, but it was just something I was used to, and it was interesting how your mind, and you see, oh, okay, that would be wrong, but it, you know, you have to think through how those changes affect you. There were lots of issues with jeeps. The guy at Seminole Ranch had the jeep, and he would, you know, fly his stuff in, and then he'd drive up in the jeep, and then we'd have to go tell him to take the jeep back down and all that. And I can't remember if there was ever legal action or how that all played out, but I do remember that being an issue. And of course, then you had to worry about the outfitters, and were they using chainsaws? And it was a constant thing.
And now it seems to be pretty accepted back there.
I think so. I mean, I don't know what the outfitters do these days, but I'm quite sure they don't do it obviously if they're using mechanized things. I think they're pretty used to having it not be. And I imagine there's been some cases over time where they have been. But, you know, you can understand how it took a while for them. That's their livelihood, and it made their work a whole lot harder when that change came along. Plus, they used to be able to leave their gear all winter. They'd have a cache of all the stuff in their tents and all those kinds of things. And, of course, it made them stop doing that. And then one of them had an old cook stove, an old, big old, you know, black wood stove. And Emil blew it up one time with dynamite. In order to get it out of there, and that irritated the outfitter community quite a bit. So there was some, you know, violent things going on to get the wilderness implemented there.
So how did you feel about these changes? Were you did you have any conflicts inside? Like, I see that this needs to happen in order for solitude or whatever wilderness character you were implementing for, but at the same time people had been doing this stuff for 20 years, and like, was it difficult for you, like, just
no, I don't think so. I remember thinking it was great, because I was very pleased that these huge pieces of land were being saved forever. And now I confess, of course, I'm living in a nice little cabin there at Moose Creek. It's not like I'm living in a tent all summer and all that sort of thing, although I probably would have been fine with that too. But, you know, it was a comfortable life there and all that. But no, I thought it was good. I liked the idea that we were making that way of life, easing it into that way of life, and that the solitude would always be there, and hopefully that, you know, the trails needed to be there so people could have access, but I like the idea that it was protected in that way, and I thought it was good. So, no, I felt very good about it. I felt like, you know, you felt like you're part of something wonderful and that's happening, and something really important.
So now when you go back there, do you see, do you feel like you were part of making that place,
I do.
Of rewilding it or whatever?
I kind of do. I mean, I certainly feel like a part of that place when I go back. I mean, it looks very much like it did when I was there. There's a few small changes, and you know, one of the big ones is, and one of the changes that occurred, although not so much while we were there, was that they started letting fires burn in the wilderness. And that wasn't really true while we were at Moose Creek specifically. It was more after we moved to Missoula that started to happen with Bob Mutch and all those guys who you know. But now, when I floated the river a couple of years ago and when I was back last summer, you notice the landscape has changed, because it used to be that the north-facing slope along the river was all green and dark timber and all that, and now lots of it snags and all that from the burns, and that's okay. I mean, you know, that's part of the continuity of nature, and it will once again be dark timber, and it will burn again, so it's good. I like I'm very fond of that.
So when you guys, I know that when my grandfather was back there, there were a lot more cabins there than there... And there probably were still a lot when you first got back there in 1968. So part of the process of rewilding the landscape was either letting those cabins rot back to earth, or like they did at Seminole Ranch, actually transporting them out or burning them.
Yes, Bill and I burned one spring, the old Faye Smith cabin, which was down below the station. Just down on the flat, a little bit north of Seminole, and yeah, I have a picture somewhere of, you know, us standing there, and I just thought, ugh. So, but yeah, it felt weird to burn that cabin. But on the other hand, it was in the wilderness and shouldn't have been a cabin, you know. Yeah. I don't know if, well, let's see, are there other cabins? I don't think there's any other cabins that are on the forest that I'm aware of that aren't, maybe you can see a sill log or something and it's part of history, but mm-hmm. I don't think there's any cabins left that aren't on private land there that I'm aware of in the Selway.
No, I don't know of any, but I have seen cabin footings mm-hmm. in some fields where you can, like hawthorns usually grow up mm-hmm. where the cabin footings are. So if you see a field with four hawthorns, mm-hmm. you know that that's probably where the four corners of a cabin is. And if you dig underneath there, you can find the footings.
And there's some place probably up by Moose Creek Ranches. There used to be daffodils in the spring that you'd see, you know, that would come up. And I think eventually they go away. But
so what? How do you feel about even just the remains of stuff like that? Like, is that because where do you make the separation from the natural environment to the historical or the cultural? And I mean, I don't think there's an answer to this.
Right.
It's all just kind of speculation. Right. But since you've been such a part of this history, I'm just wondering how you feel about it.
I'm actually okay with places where you can see the old sill logs and stuff, and I like being able to find out, like through projects such as yours, for example, who lived there and why they were there and what they did there and all that, and going, oh, okay, that's the remains of somebody's dream from one point, but now it's part of the, because you can't ever make anything completely pristine again, just not possible.
No.
And so I think it's okay if there's little bits left. I mean, I was pretty happy to see the Seminole Ranch gone, because it was, you know, it was awfully modern and all that sort of thing and didn't need to be there since the Forest Service had purchased the land. But you know, maybe just because I was there, but I'm not offended by going by North Star or Selway Lodge or anything where there still are buildings. And, you know, they may not be there someday, I don't know. But
yeah.
But I think it's okay. I don't mind seeing it.
Yeah.
Because it's wonderful to be in those places to enjoy nature, but I'm also fascinated by the history of why people are there and what made them come there and all that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. And I grew up with lots of people who lived like that, and mm-hmm. it's just interesting, I mm-hmm. think. So I like it.
And can you just talk a little bit more about burning that cabin, what it was like?
Well, we just walked down. I think it was, pretty sure it was in the spring. No one else was around, I don't think. And we probably took down some white gas or something and just poured it on the foundation and burned it up. And it burned up in, you know, a short amount of time. And I assume we went down late, but must have gone back later and cleaned up the residue from the burning. I don't remember actually doing that, but maybe some of the staff did. But I do remember that. But it seemed, I don't think in those days I knew who Fay Smith was, and obviously I had not heard the tapes of him and all that sort of thing. And I probably would, I might have felt a little differently, or it's not that I wouldn't have wanted to do it, but it would have felt more poignant, I think, had I known that beforehand. Yeah.
So when you moved back to Idaho, what was it, 7 years ago?
It's 8 years ago
this year.
Yeah, in 2005.
So were there things that you noticed about, because I know you've been going into the backcountry a lot mm-hmm. and since you moved back, that you thought, oh, I forgot about this. I remember how much I love this. Or do you have
those kind of
moments?
I think one of the things is the smells. Oh my gosh, the smells of balsam fir or, you know, spruce trees or something, or those really wet places where that's mossy and all that. I love that. It's great. I like that. And I just like being out where there are no people. I mean, I can cope with people, but I think it's better to be where there are no people. So okay. I enjoy that a lot. And I love the Palouse. I just think it's the most beautiful, sensual landscape there is anywhere. I would come home at least once or twice a year from D.C., and I would always fly to Spokane and rent a car and drive to Dixie, and it was always like, oh, when you started out, left Spokane and started out the Palouse, it's the most peaceful landscape I've always thought. So, you know, you always just, that was always in the back of your head when you remember the wonderful places. And maybe all that stuff gets you through when there's a lot of crowding and irritation and you're in traffic for hours and all that. Yeah. Good memories to
That's
start
cool.
with.
That's cool. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project, which has been made possible by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Idaho, and Washington State University. The project coordinator is Debbie Lee. Recorded and produced by Aaron Jepson.